The name of the show is Country Connections, and its mission is to connect you with the golden age of country music. Tune in at 7 o'clock Saturday mornings right here on KPFT.
Hi, I'm Al Stahaley, and you're listening to KPFT Houston 90.1.
Welcome to another edition of the Progressive Forum. The Progressive Forum covers issues such as human rights, the environment, politics, and peace and justice, in addition to presenting news, commentary, and a weekly calendar of events.
This is KPFT in Houston, the programs of Progressive Forum. I'm Wally James. Our special guest today is Tom Hartman, and his latest book is The Last American President. We're going to go to Jim Hightower, and we'll be right back with Tom Hartman.
An essential part of our children's education is learning proper moral behavior. And who better to deliver that ethical guidance than politicians? Huh? Bizarre, yet this is the conclusion of the GOP's theocratic Christian nationalist faction. They're demanding that legislatures across the country must intervene in local educational policy to require that all public schools plaster every classroom with Christianity's Ten Commandments. It's in-your-face religiosity, forcing one religious dogma on students of every faith. It's also ludicrously hypocritical. After all, legislators are notorious for committing adultery, stealing from the poor, killing in the name of the state, bearing false witness against immigrants, and bowing down to false gods, and otherwise mocking the Christian religion's own commandments. Who do these nationalists and their politicians think they're fooling? Certainly not America's free-thinking students. If you wonder whether young people will just go along, take heart in the uplifting thoughts of Arjun Sharda, a high school freshman in Round Rock, Texas. In a recent op-ed piece, he went right at the humbuggery of the state's Republican leaders. The same lawmakers who preach about freedom and limited government, he wrote, are now legislating what we must hang on our classroom walls. But faith loses its power when it's forced. True belief comes from conviction, not compulsion. Texas prides itself in independence, yet this law enforces conformity. This is Jim Hightower saying, the Christian nationalist autocrats are not only trying to turn public classrooms into their exclusive pulpits, but to establish their repressive theology as America's official religion. As Sharda warns, Texas should stop confusing religion with righteousness before the wall between church and state becomes just another thing we've torn down.
This is KPFT in Houston. The program's a Progressive Forum. I'm Wally James, and our special guest today is Tom Hartman. His latest book is The Last American President, A Broken Man, A Corrupt Party, and A World on the Brink. Tom, welcome back to the Progressive Forum.
Hey, Wally. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, well, thank you.
I'm hearing my own voice coming back at me, by the way. I don't know if somebody needs to push a mix-minus button someplace.
That's how the show will be for tonight. Okay. So sorry. A little bit of a technical difficulty, but the interview should continue like normal.
Okay. So that my producer was just saying that there's a glitch in the system, and they can't do much about it. So I hope it doesn't distract too much.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Well, it's great to have you back on the show. It's been a while. And the first thing I'd like to talk about is this election we just had a couple of days ago. And it's caught a lot of people by surprise. What was your impact? How did it affect you?
Well, it was very encouraging, actually. I think a lot of us were very discouraged, thinking that, you know, the country's screwed and there's nothing the Democrats can do and the Republicans have won and they're going to kill everybody and they're going to take your, you know, kill off everybody's political freedom anyway and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, I think what the election taught us is that, you know, we still have agency, we still have power, we still have a voice. There's a hell of a lot more of us out there. I mean, we saw victories in places that nobody expected. I mean, you know, like on the Public Utilities Commission in Georgia, on school boards in Texas. I mean, it was a blowout. I think it was a substantial victory. And, you know, the question now is Donald Trump and the people around him, are they going to use that, that victory, as it were, or that loss, rather, on their part? Are they going to use that to moderate their policies, you know, and try and grab back the center, which is what mostly swung, it seems? Or are they going to try to make it harder to vote? Are they going to double down on repression and violence? My guess is they'll do the latter, but, you know, we'll see.
Oh, yeah. I mean, with his nature, it definitely seems like, you know, he's going to go the way that doesn't support the American people and, you know, just do what he thinks is best for him and his corporate overlords or whatever you want to call them.
Yeah.
So what
was that a question?
I was supposed to be. Basically, this was a huge upset. And do you see the Democrats really taking advantage of this? Because they're really going to have to get on the ball.
Yeah, the Democrats are facing, you know, a couple of real serious issues right now. You know, one is what is the Democratic Party? Mm-hmm. You know, from 1934 until 1992, the Democratic Party, by and large, was the party of Franklin Roosevelt, Lyndon Johnson, Jimmy Carter, Jack Kennedy, and Bob Kennedy. You know, basically the government of a large, or the party of a large government that can actually accomplish things, that can actually do things, that can make things work for people, and that you know, stands up for principles and an activist government, as it were. And, you know, Reagan came along and said that all that's wrong and you got to do away with all that. And, you know, the drill, Wally, you know, mm-hmm. You got to cut taxes and use that as an excuse for the deficit to kill off the social programs and stop having the government build this nasty middle class thing that just seems to create people who protest. Be they black or students or women or whatever, and you know, replace that with you know, corporate, you know, privatize everything, like corporations, hand Social Security off to corporations. We're already more than halfway through handing Medicare off to corporations. That was initiated by George W. Bush in 2003. Privatized Medicaid. Most Medicaid is now being handled actually in the states by private for-profit health insurance companies. You know, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I could go through a whole long list. They haven't gotten around to privatizing our fire departments yet, but they're, you know, now talking about privatizing police functions by having bounty hunters work with ICE and that kind of stuff. So, you know, the Republican Party in the 80s had this sales pitch, this neoliberal sales pitch that big government is bad and the taxes are bad and that, you know, we just need to let the free market and the billionaires run everything and it'll be a paradise.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, 44 years later, we know it's a lie. But in 1992, Bill Clinton didn't know it was a lie. He thought it sounded like a pretty good idea. And so he adopted an awful lot of it. And Barack Obama followed in his footsteps. You know, when we needed a national health care program, he brought out Romney Care, the program that the Heritage Foundation had come up with back in the 90s as a rebuttal to Hillary Clinton's single-payer program that she was planning on putting together, and that Mitt Romney put into place in Massachusetts when he was governor of that state. And, you know, out of that came Obamacare, which was always a Republican plan. It was always a Heritage Foundation, big corporation, insurance company funded plan. And in truth, it's handed several $1 trillion in profits and revenue to the, you know, the six largest insurance companies and a whole bunch of smaller ones, too. So the first guy to come along and actually push back against that and go back to the Democratic roots of the Democratic Party was Joe Biden. You know, he was the first president to walk a picket line. He wanted to do a massive government stimulus program. He wanted to wipe out student and medical debt. I mean, you know, he was a genuine progressive, and he did a marvelous job. He just was completely incompetent at communicating it. And in this era of social media and you know, everybody on and looking at their phones all the time, you've got to be a good communicator to be president. That's like, it's become job one, sadly. It's just like, you know, in the 60s when Kennedy ran, before Kennedy, you could look like anything pretty much on TV and it didn't matter. But, you know, starting in the 60s, you had to look pretty damn good on TV in order to win an election. So, you know, it doesn't mean you had to be handsome, but you had to know how to use the camera. I mean, Lyndon Johnson knew how to do that, too. And so, you know, now there's this different skill set that's necessary. So Democrats are really struggling with, number one, are we going to, you know, hang on to the Clinton neoliberalism, you know, which is what Hillary and some of the other, you know, the old Clinton crowd want. And some of them are going away. I mean, Jared Golden is, you know, right up at the top of that list, and he just said that he's not going to run for reelection. And I think it's because he's got a progressive challenger. He says it's because he's tired of the death threats, but, you know, come on. You know, that's just part of the game. But I think that, you know, is the party going to go progressive like Joe Biden started, or is it going to go back to, you know, the way that Kamala Harris is talking, which is, you know, more so-called moderate, which is really, you know, we still have, you know, one hand in the corporate till. And, you know, I'm not sure. I think Mamdani, on the one hand, his massive victory suggests, hey, let's go progressive. It looks like that works. On the other hand, you can go all the way back to 1925, you know, LaGuardia, Figueroa, I'm forgetting all the names, John, what was his name, the handsome guy who was – there was, you know, virtually I'm mixing up my New York City mayors. But anyhow, virtually every New York City mayor since 1925 has won by at least a 60% margin, most of them by a 70 or 75% margin. And Mondani only won by 50%. So you got people on the Clinton side saying, oh, yeah, you know what, that doesn't prove anything. You know, he was running against two very flawed candidates, you know, a right-wing crackpot, Curtis Sliwa, and a disgraced, you know, accused sexual, you know, pervert or whatever, you know, in Cuomo. But on the other hand, people on the left are saying, well, you know, if he hadn't been running against a Democrat, Cuomo, you know, who had been endorsed by other Democrats like Bloomberg, you know, he may well have, you know, pulled that 60 or 70%. So you can't really draw any lessons from it. I'm not sure which side is right. But, you know, because Spanberger Mikey Sherrill were both so-called moderate Democrats. They're happy to take, you know, AIPAC money and corporate money and stuff like that. And they have, you know, solid defense backgrounds. But, you know, I do think the Democratic Party has to be a big tent. We have to have, you know, all types of Democrats in it. But broadly speaking, in national elections, and particularly the next presidential election, the party's got to figure out its identity and it's got to speak with one voice. The Republicans have done that. It's served them well. The Democrats need to make that job one right now.
Well, and what Trump and the Republicans are doing is hurting the American people. And, you know, some people are waking up to it. Do you see this sweeping across the country and people waking up to what's going on?
Well, yeah, I think that's very much what we just saw. And, you know, in even small elections, local elections, county elections, township elections, you saw Democrats wildly overperforming and overperforming way beyond even what we saw with the Obama wave, mm-hmm. you know, in 2008. So, yeah, I'm pretty optimistic about that. Again, the question is, how much of that is a vote for Democrats as opposed to a vote against Trump? And if Trump changes his tune, or if Trump you know, becomes incapacitated or drops dead, I mean, he's 79, and he seems to be having little mini strokes or half his face sags and stuff like that. You know, if he's out of the picture, then how does the Democratic Party position itself against Vance, and how does Vance position himself you know, against the Democratic Party. So far, he's been to the right of Trump. He's been pushing hardcore neo-fascism, you know, Moldicus Goldbug or whatever his name is, you know. But, you know, how would that change? How would that change the dynamic? How would that change the Republican Party? Are there still Republicans in the House and Senate who want to go back to the Mitt Romney, John McCain Republican Party as opposed to the Donald Trump, right-wing neo-fascist Republican Party? There's a lot of unknowns that are still there, Wally.
Well, and you've got Trump saying that if anybody crosses him, you know, he's going to, you know, put somebody against them in their next election. So do you see anybody, you know, taking that on?
We're starting to see that, around the Epstein files. And, of course, that's because the Epstein files have become such a big deal in QAnon circles, which, you know, has become a large part of the Republican base. So you've got Tom Massey and Marjorie Taylor Greene and Nancy Mace and Lauren Boebert now coming out and saying that they're going to vote with the Democrats to release the Epstein files. And, you know, eventually Johnson's going to have to swear in Adelita Grijalva. There is, according to the news reports I'm reading today, a big story about it today on Raw Story, this belief that Michael Wolff was probably right when he said that Jeffrey Epstein showed him pictures of Donald Trump with underage teenage girls who were topless sitting on his lap, and perhaps things even more, you know, salacious than that, or illegal than that, and that the stuff that's in the files is worse than anybody thinks. And when Pam Bondi was asked about that by Sheldon Whitehouse under oath in testimony, she refused to answer the question. So now you've got Republicans who are kind of flipping out about this and, you know, trying to figure out what to do next and how long they can hold that off. I think that if those pictures actually are there, and if they are forced out, and frankly, I'm not expecting that. Even if this thing passes the House, it goes to the Senate where it'll get filibustered by the Republicans. Even if it passes the Senate, Donald Trump will veto it. Even if there is something that forces these files out, my guess is that most of them have already been destroyed by now. I mean, I'm just not optimistic that we're ever going to learn how deeply criminal Donald Trump's activity was around these young girls, assuming that if that was even the case, and, Michael Wolff notwithstanding. So, you know, these are the early cracks showing up. You've also got now Donald Trump demanding that John Thune blow up the filibusters so that he can, pass the clean CR and open the government back up again.
Yeah.
And that pressure is really going to ramp up this weekend as they start dialing back on flights. And so, you know, that's going to be interesting to watch. I am with Trump. I think that they should blow up the filibuster. I wrote an op-ed about it today. In fact, I think people should call their Democratic senators and say, you know, go along with these guys and blow up the filibuster, because it'll be great when Democrats get back into power. And yes, I get it. Republicans will do a hell of a lot of damage in the meantime. But that's, you know, they've been hiding behind the filibuster for years, saying, oh, we can't really pass this because the Democrats will just filibuster. Now they won't have that excuse. So either the American people are going to be pissed off at them, or their donors are going to be pissed off at them. It's really going to put them in a hard spot. And John Thune knows that, which is why he's refusing to do it. And you've got five or six other Democrat or Republicans, rather, who are refusing to go along with ending the filibuster. But if we could get some Democrats to go along with it, I think it could really insert a huge wedge within the Republican caucus in the Senate.
That would be amazing if they can do it. Something needs to shake things up. It's just not working the way it is.
It's true. It's very true. We'll see how it shakes out.
Yeah. Well, okay, we've talked quite a bit about this. What else are you seeing right now that you're really concerned about?
Well, I think the two big areas that have me spooked are the climate and the economy.
Yeah.
The economy seems to be in trouble. And I think we've got a massive bubble going on with AI right now. You know, if it wasn't for AI, most of your industrial and retail sectors are right now in recession. AI is about the only thing that's holding up the stock market, and increasingly people are warning about the dangers of that. It's looking an awful lot like 1999 with the dot-com bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's this thing, Moore's Law, that says that every 2 years, processing power doubles and prices are cut in half. And that has been happening. In fact, it's been happening faster than that with these super high-tech chips. NVIDIA is making them. And now you've got AMT and I'm forgetting the name of the other company. They're right here in Portland that are moving into that space. And then another company just announced that you no longer need to have dozens of chips, you know, soldered to a circuit board any longer. They're doing the whole thing on a single wafer. And when that comes along, that'll be, you know, that'll be like we went from the transistor to the integrated circuit, and then we went from the integrated circuit to you know, the high-density integrated circuits. And, you know, that'll be a whole nother major leap. And when that happens, the need for power and the need for the construction of all these giant processing facilities will be cut in half, or maybe by an order of magnitude. And that's going to collapse the stock market, I think. WorldCom went out of business when suddenly, you know, we went from 1G to 2G to 3G and figured out, you know, algorithms that we could use to push massively larger amounts of data through the exact same internet pipes. I think that's coming with AI. And although AI is continuing to grow and it's showing up in more and more places and more devices. But in the midst of this, now we've got the Republicans having blocked, you know, a lot of Biden's efforts. They're making it harder to unionize. They're undoing his union efforts. They're undoing much of his stimulus spending, which was supporting the economy, and his green stuff. And these are all, you know, that on top of Trump's tariffs is like, you know, just taking a sledgehammer to the economy. Right now it's not showing because the government shut down and they're not publishing the statistics, but it looks like we've lost about 1 million jobs since the first of the year, at least according to, private statistics that were released today and published in the Wall Street Journal from, you know, one of these employment companies. So you got that. And then on top of that, we're seeing climate change just wreak absolute havoc. I mean, here in Portland last night, we had a tornado alert. You just don't have tornado alerts in the Pacific Northwest.
No.
Yeah, it doesn't happen. You've got drought, you've got wildfires, you've got floods, you've got these atmospheric rivers that didn't used to exist, derechos, you know, mile-long tornadic walls of activity. You just had a hurricane that hit the Dominican Republic and Cuba. And Jamaica, that was stronger than any that's ever been seen in the history of the world. And this is just the beginning. I mean, you know, we're just passing 2.5. We're at 3 now, degrees Celsius of warming. And we're 15 years ahead of where the COP conference said we would be way back in 2016. So, and it's getting to the point where you can't buy homeowners insurance in large chunks of Florida, along the Gulf Coast in the south. Parts of California, parts of the rocky mountain areas and forested areas. These are causing massive economic dislocations that drive us to housing. Those are the things that I think are, could create kind of black swan events that would be very, very disruptive to our economy and thus ultimately to our nation and our democracy.
Yes. It's mind-boggling.
It is, yeah.
We've got, excuse me, I just get flabbergasted when I think about this stuff. It's like they're literally trying to destroy the country.
Yeah, and they're doing it to save the tax breaks for, you know, a handful of billionaires. There's 140 billionaire families who supported the Trump campaign. There's probably about 300 or 400 billionaire families that are big supporters of politics in the United States. 3 or 4 of them support Democrats. The rest all support Republicans. And multi millionaires, decimillionaires, and 100 millionaires. And, you know, one of the more recent shocking statistics was that more than half of all economic spending in the United States, excuse me, more than 80% of all economic spending in the United States is coming from the top 10%. Well, when the top 10% starts spending, and they will when the stock market crashes, then you're going to see something that's going to look like the late 1920s, early 1930s, or at least, you know, an early maybe not that bad, but certainly as bad as 2008, you know, the Bush crash, or 2000, you know, the dot-com bubble bursting, and that could have really significant political consequences. So, you know, hang on to your hat here, Walter.
Yeah, it's getting scary, that's for sure. We've got a few minutes left, a little while. While we do have some time with you, what would you like to focus on in this time that we have?
Well, I think that one of the biggest challenges that we're facing right now is the creation of a police state.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no doubt in my mind that Donald Trump intends to use this to intimidate voters, that that's his ultimate goal. You know, that's the way Putin did it. It's the way Orban did it. On top of his gerrymandering and all that kind of stuff. And the big problem that we have that's unique to the United States relative to most other democratic nations, small d democratic nations, is that we're the only advanced democracy in the world. Out of the 34 OECD countries, we're the only one. We have a few unique characteristics. We're the only one that doesn't have a national healthcare system. We're the only one that doesn't have free college. But most importantly, we're the only one that doesn't say that voting is a right rather than a privilege. And as a result of that, in the 2024 election, Greg Palast, the BBC reporter who has a master's degree in statistics, went to the federal and state governments and got the actual hard statistics on, you know, who voted, who was registered to vote, who tried to vote, all that kind of stuff, and found that about 3.5 million people were purged from the voting rolls just before the election by Republicans in swing states. And another million or so, even though they voted, their votes were challenged and never counted. And the result of that was about 4.2 million people who were almost all largely Democratic voters, most of them Black or Hispanic people, or people who lived in college towns or areas that were just known to be very, very blue. And had those people been able to vote, according to Palast's math, we would have had Kamala Harris in the White House and Democrats running both the House and Senate. Dealing with that, those structural problems, I think, are going to be the real challenge over the next 3 years, because the Republicans are going to try and take that 4 million and turn it into 10 million. I mean, that's what Putin and Orban did, and obviously Trump is running on their playbook.
Yeah, and that's really concerning, what's going on. And I'm just not hearing the mainstream media picking up on this and the peril that this puts us in.
Yeah, the mainstream media doesn't like to talk about it, because when Trump did his lies about the 2020 election being stolen, his big hoax, his big lie,
mm-hmm.
The mainstream media universally panned it, pointed out he's lying to you. And don't get hysterical, and elections are secure and everything's good. And so now if they were to come out and say, well, everything's not really good, you know, the system actually is rigged and it's Republicans who are rigging it. Well, first of all, most of our media is now owned by partisan Republicans, you know, Republican billionaires. But secondly, they don't want to say that. They think that'll cause them to have egg on their face. And so the result of this is that, you know, we've got this very confused information ecosystem that isn't telling people what's really going on and is frankly afraid to, you know, reluctant to. I think it's very distressing. It's very disturbing. And Democrats, the astonishing thing to me is that this information has been out there for years. The Republicans started these voter suppression efforts based on a lie of illegal immigrants voting, non-citizens voting, in 1964 with Operation Eagle Eye that was run by William Rehnquist out of Arizona. He rode that all the way to becoming Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. And, you know, he used to stand outside Hispanic and Mexican and Native American polling places and challenge people's votes. He was a big bear of a man, and he could intimidate people with, and he knew the law. And that poison, that lie, has grown to the point where, you know, in the last 10 years, we've had over 30 million people purged off the voting rolls in the United States and you know, who probably shouldn't have been purged. Now, people get themselves put back on over and over and over again. But still, I mean, this is the way that the Republicans, this is pretty much the only way that the Republicans are winning elections in anywhere except deep red states. So you've got that. And then on top of that, you've got 1,500 right-wing radio stations. You've got all these right-wing bloggers who are heavily subsidized by right-wing billionaires. You've got a right-wing information ecosystem, three right-wing television networks that are just constantly pumping out propaganda, lies, and distractions, and will never tell people what the Republicans are really up to, or, for that matter, the good stuff that the Democrats have done. And so you've got an astonishingly ignorant populace right now in terms of, you know, what's really going on. You don't see this in most other countries because most other countries don't allow their media to be dominated like this. Again, this is what Putin and Orban did. They had their oligarch buddies come in and buy up all the major media. And so, you know, we've got the Democrats and anybody who believes in democracy in America, we've got a hell of a big job ahead of us. Well, we've got a lot of work to do.
We really do. You want to leave us with a closing thought?
Well, get out there, get active, tag, you're it.
All right. Tom, thank you so much for spending this time with us. I really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Wally. Thanks for the invitation.
All right. You take care. All right. Coming up next, we have a bird's eye view with Lillian Kerr.
A bird's eye view, a woman's perspective with Lillian Kerr. This is a look at American journalist Dorothy Thompson. This information comes from the website A Mighty Girl. In 1931, American journalist Dorothy Thompson secured what many considered an impossible interview, a rare audience with Adolf Hitler, the leader of Germany's rapidly ascending Nazi Party, at the Kaiserhof Hotel in Berlin. For one of her three permitted questions, Thompson asked Hitler a direct challenge. When you come to power, will you abolish the Constitution of the United States? Hitler's response was shockingly direct. I will get into power legally. I will abolish this parliament and the Weimar Constitution afterward. I will found an authority state from the lowest cell to the highest instance. Everywhere there will be responsibility and authority above, discipline and obedience below. Thompson believed he was telling the truth about his dictatorial ambitions, yet she couldn't fathom that he would be successful. The very idea struck her as absurd. Imagine a would-be dictator setting out to persuade a sovereign people to vote away their rights. Thompson, one of America's most respected foreign correspondents and the first female head of a European news bureau, had been tracking the Nazi movement since 1923. At the time of the interview, she was deeply familiar with Hitler, having watched his speeches, read Mein Kampf, and interviewed numerous German politicians and Nazi supporters. When I walked into Adolf Hitler's salon in the Kaiserhof Hotel, I was convinced that I was meeting the future dictator of Germany, Thompson later reflected. In something like 50 seconds, I was quite sure that I was not. It took just about that time to measure the startling insignificance of this man who has set the world agog. She recognized that Hitler was a masterful propagandist and orator in front of a crowd, but she wasn't prepared for how pathetic he appeared one-on-one. He is inconsequent and voluble, ill-poised, insecure. He is the very prototype of the little man, she wrote after their meeting. Thompson found the interview nearly impossible to conduct. One cannot carry on a conversation with Adolf Hitler. In every question, he seeks for a theme that will set him off Then his eyes focus in some far corner of the room. A hysterical note creeps into his voice, which rises almost to a scream. He gives the impression of a man in a trance. He bangs the table. Following this interview, in numerous articles and her book, I Saw Hitler, Dorothy Thompson warned about the threat Hitler represented to democracy and highlighted Hitler's embrace of racial prejudice, noting that persecution of the Jewish people was among the first planks in his program. But ultimately, she viewed an outright Nazi victory in the upcoming election as unlikely. Not believing that German citizens would embrace such an extremist demagogue in an election, within a year, Thompson learned the devastating lesson of how easily democratic citizens could be persuaded to relinquish their rights to a would-be dictator who channeled their anxieties into hatred of a demonized other while promising national greatness. After he came to power in 1933, Hitler began to crush his political opponents, rapidly militarize German society, and persecute targeted groups. Thompson quickly became one of the most vocal chroniclers of Hitler's growing brutality, warning a world that was largely oblivious. "It must be said, it must be reiterated," she wrote, "that there has been and still is a widespread terror which extends throughout the whole of Germany." Hitler was sufficiently threatened by Thompson's work that he reportedly demanded the creation of a Dorothy Thompson emergency squad to rush translations of her articles to him. In August 1934, the Nazi government expelled Thompson from the country, making her the first American journalist banned from Nazi Germany. Thompson turned her expulsion into a rallying cry, writing in the New York Times, "My offense was to think that Hitler's just an ordinary man, that it is a crime against the reigning cult in Germany, which says Mr. Hitler is a messiah sent by God to save the German people. To question this mystic mission is so heinous that, if you are a German, you can be sent to jail. I, fortunately, am an American, so I merely was sent to Paris." Returning to America, Dorothy Thompson embarked on what became a phenomenon in itself, a one-woman crusade determined to awaken America and the Western world to the real and present menace of the rise of far-right fascism and the terrible war that might be needed to stop its spread throughout the entire West. Thompson was one of the most widely read and heard journalists in America at the time, reaching millions through her influential On the Record column and nightly NBC radio broadcasts. In her broadcasts and columns, she often championed Jewish refugees and consistently emphasized Hitler's attack on Jewish people as central to understanding the Nazi threat. Thompson's warnings extended beyond Europe, and she often warned about the growing rise of fascism within America. In 1939, she made headlines for attending a rally of the German-American Bund, an organization of American Nazis at Madison Square Garden, where she was seated in the press office, and she began to laugh and disrupted the speeches. She was escorted out by the police, but she returned to her seat, where she was surrounded by a dozen Bund stormtroopers. Then she proceeded to cause a second scene by shouting, "Bunk!" at the stage. Her point was this can happen anywhere. University of London professor Sarah Churchill, who studied Thompson's work, explained, "You have to strengthen your democratic guardrails. You have to ensure that you don't let this happen to you because complacency is the enemy." And that is what she wrote about over and over and over again, banging the drum. Warning people, take this seriously. This isn't a joke. Nobody is immune to it. Thompson's most enduring warning came in a 1937 column that resonates with chilling relevance today. "Nobody ever recognizes their dictator in advance," she wrote. "He never stands for election on the platform of dictatorship. He always represents himself as the instrument expressing the incorporated national will. When Americans think of dictators, they always think of some foreign model. If anyone turned up here in a fur hat, boots, and a grim look, he would be recognized and shunned. But when our dictator turns up, you can depend on it. He will be one of the boys. And he will stand for everything traditionally American, through whose leadership alone democracy can be realized. And nobody will ever say Heil to him, or Ave Caesar, nor will they call him Führer or Il Duce, but they will greet him with one great big universal democratic sheep-like bleat. Okay, chief, fix it like you want to, chief. Okay. Thompson saw no conflict between her roles as a journalist and as a staunch voice for anti-fascism. The function of journalism and the free press is not confined to the presentation of news. Their function is to create continual debate, to provide a forum, and to give opportunity for the expression of freedom. By 1939, Time magazine recognized Dorothy Thompson and Eleanor Roosevelt as the two most influential women in America, a testament to how her relentless warnings and the threat of fascism had broken through American complacency. Yet her warnings about authoritarianism, cloaked in the language of patriotism, echo across the decades with haunting clarity, reminding us that the defense of democracy demands not a single victory, but eternal vigilance from each generation wishing to remain free. And that was a little glimpse of the extraordinary life of American journalist Dorothy Thompson. This has been Lillian Kerr with A Bird's Eye View.
Letters from an American with Heather Cox Richardson.
November 5th, 2025. New York City Mayor-elect Zoran Mamdani, a member of both the Democratic Party and the Democratic Socialists of America, began his victory speech last night with a nod to Eugene V. Debs, labor organizer and socialist candidate for president at the turn of the last century. "The sun may have set over our city this evening, but as Eugene Debs once said, I can see the dawn of a better day for humanity." The 34-year-old mayor-elect speech went on to deliver something that was more than a victory speech. It marked a new era, much like the one that had given rise to Debs himself. After more than 40 years in which ordinary Americans had seen the political system being stacked against them and over time forgotten they had agency to change it, they had woken up. Mamdani began by lifting up New York City's working people, noting that, for as long as we can remember, they have been told by the wealthy and the well-connected that power does not belong in their hands. "And yet," he said, "over the last 12 months, you have dared to reach for something greater. Tonight, against all odds, we have grasped it. The future is in our hands." New York, he said, had delivered a mandate for change, a mandate for a new kind of politics, a mandate for a city we can afford, and a mandate for a government that delivers exactly that. Mamdani thanked the next generation of New Yorkers who refused to accept that the promise of a better future was a relic of the past. And that was the heart of his message, that democracy belongs to ordinary people. "We will fight for you," he said, "because we are you." He thanked Yemeni bodega owners and Mexican abuelas, Senegalese taxi drivers and Uzbek nurses, Trinidadian line cooks and Ethiopian aunties. He assured every New Yorker in Kensington and Midwood and Hunts Point that this city is your city and this democracy is yours too. Mamdani celebrated the hard work of democracy in his win. "It was a victory not just for all those who make up New York City," he said, "but also for the more than 100,000 volunteers who built this campaign into an unstoppable force. With every door knocked, every petition signature earned, and every hard-earned conversation, you eroded the cynicism that has come to define our politics." With that base of Americans engaged in the work of democracy, Mamdani welcomed a new era. "There are many who thought this day would never come, and who feared that we would be condemned only to a future of less, with every election consigning us simply to more of the same," he said. "And there are others who see politics today as too cruel for the flame of hope to still burn." But in New York City last night, he said, "We have answered those fears. Hope is alive. Hope is a decision that tens of thousands of New Yorkers made day after day, volunteer shift after volunteer shift, despite attack ad after attack ad. More than a million of us stood in our churches, in gymnasiums, in community centers, as we filled in the ledger of democracy. And while we cast our ballots alone, we chose hope together. Hope over tyranny. Hope over big money and small ideas. Hope over despair. We won because New Yorkers allowed themselves to hope that the impossible could be made possible. And we won because we insisted that no longer would politics be something that is done to us. Now it is something that we do. Mamdani promised a government that would answer to the demands of the people. It would address the city's cost of living crisis, invest in education, improve infrastructure, and cut bureaucratic waste. It would, he said, work with police officers to reduce crime while also defending community safety and demanding excellence in government. Mamdani pushed back not just against the smears thrown his way during the campaign, but also against the deliberate division of the country that has been a staple of Republican rhetoric since 1972, when President Richard Nixon's Vice President Spiro Agnew embraced his role as the key purveyor of positive polarization. In its place, he called for community and solidarity. In this new age we make for ourselves, Mamdani said, we will refuse to allow those who traffic in division and hate to pit us against one another. Here we believe in standing up for those we love, whether you're an immigrant, a member of the trans community, one of the many black women that Donald Trump has fired from a federal job, a single mom still waiting for the cost of groceries to go down, or anyone else with their back against the wall. Your struggle is ours, too. Mamdani, who is Muslim, promised to build a city hall that stands steadfast alongside Jewish New Yorkers and does not waver in the fight against the scourge of anti-Semitism, where the more than 1 million Muslims know that they belong, not just in the five boroughs of this city, but in the halls of power. He called for a government of both competence and compassion. For years, he said, those in City Hall have only helped those who can help them. But on January 1st, we will usher in a city government that helps everyone. Mamdani took on the problem of disinformation in modern politics, noting that many have heard our message only through the prism of misinformation. Tens of millions of dollars have been spent to redefine reality and to convince our neighbors that this new age is something that should frighten them. He laid that disinformation at the feet of the very wealthy in their quest to divide working Americans to make sure they retain power. As so often occurred, he said, the billionaire class has sought to convince those making $30 an hour that their enemies are those earning $20 an hour. They want the people to fight amongst ourselves so that we remain distracted from the work of remaking a long broken system. Mamdani urged New Yorkers to embrace a brave new course rather than fleeing from it. If they do, he said, we can respond to oligarchy and authoritarianism with the strength it fears, not the appeasement it craves. Mamdani identified the popular momentum to defeat President Donald J. Trump, but made the point that the goal is not simply to stop Trump, but also to stop the next Trump who comes along. While Mamdani's prescription focused on the avenues of resistance open to New York City government, he emphasized that for the president to get to any of us, he will have to get through all of us. Mamdani called for New Yorkers to leave mediocrity in our past and for Democrats to dare to be great. When Mamdani said, New York, this power, it's yours, and told New Yorkers, this city belongs to you, millions of Americans heard a reminder that they too are powerful and that the government of the United States of America belongs to them. Mamdani won election yesterday, backed by just over half the city's voters, in an election characterized by extraordinarily high turnout. Andy Newman of the New York Times noted yesterday that in the last four New York City mayoral elections, fewer than a third of registered voters turned out. Yesterday, more than 2 million voters voted, the highest turnout for a mayoral election since 1969. And that turnout is a key part of the story of yesterday's Democratic wave. As Mamdani said, American voters appear, once again, to be aware of their agency in our democracy.
Letters from an American was written and read by Heather Cox Richardson, with music composed by Michael Moss.
This is the news on the Progressive Forum. 3.5 million Texans, including 1.7 million Texas children, receive food on the Supplemental Nutrition and Assistance Program from the federal government. These Texans have become political collateral as the U.S. Congress waffles over how to fund benefits for the month of November. Last Friday, two federal judges ordered the Trump administration to fund the food program. This came after states were notified last month that the USDA would not pay out benefits because the federal government is shut down. The United States Department of Agriculture said it will pay at most 50% of what people would typically receive for the month. By yesterday, Texans have not seen any November SNAP benefits, which could take days to distribute. In SNAP's 60-year history, recipients up to now have never gone without a monthly payment for food. So-called lawmakers in Congress are in a stalemate since October the 1st, causing the longest U.S. government shutdown on record. Democrats demand that Congress address the expiring health insurance subsidies, while Republicans refuse to negotiate until the government reopens. SNAP offers critical federal food assistance to our nation's poorest citizens. Democrats in the Texas State Legislature warned Governor Greg Abbott of the long-term effects on Texas. Democrat state senators wrote to Governor Abbott that suspending federal benefits could intensify an already critical demand for food assistance across Texas. The senators are urging Mr. Abbott to allocate state funds to support SNAP food recipients. Texas voters approved Proposition 4, authorizing $20 billion to be spent on statewide water projects over the next 20 years. The vote comes at a time when communities are attempting to find new water supplies to meet the needs of their growing populations. At the same time, deteriorating infrastructure and a warming climate threaten the state's water supply. A portion of existing Texas state sales tax revenue of up to $1 billion each year would be deposited into the Texas Water Fund. These funds will deposit each year starting in 2027 to help finance water, wastewater, and flood infrastructure projects. The funding comes from existing revenue with no new taxes created. However, the money would only be transferred to the water fund contingent upon Texas sales tax collections exceeding $46.5 billion in a given year. Thus, only if there is enough sales tax revenue each year will there be enough money available to dedicate the $1 billion yearly to the water fund. $20 billion is far short of what Texas needs to maintain its water infrastructure. Per one estimate, Texas communities need $154 billion over the next 50 years for water projects. Sudan's ambassador to the United Nations has called on the international community to apply stronger pressure on the United Arab Emirates. Sudan accuses the United Arab Emirates of supplying the Sudanese Rapid Support Forces with military arms and funding amid the war that has ravaged Sudan for over 2 years. Sudan's ambassador said that the supplier of arms to the Rapid Support Forces is very well known to be the United Arab Emirates. The United Arab Emirates has denied involvement in Sudan's war, rejecting allegations that it supplied weapons or mercenaries to the Rapid Support Forces through neighboring countries. Open source investigations and international reports have demonstrated evidence of logistical and financial support from the United Arab Emirates to these rapid support forces. On Tuesday, the United Nations Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs denounced that violence is intensifying across Sudan's North Darfur state. This increased violence follows the takeover of North Darfur state's capital, El Fasher, by these rapid support forces. On Wednesday, at least 40 Sudanese were killed and dozens injured after an attack by these paramilitary group rapid support forces. The rapid support forces attacked a funeral gathering in the city of Al Obeid, the capital of Sudan's North Kordofan state. In and around the city of Al Obeid, there are tens of thousands of displaced Sudanese who fled violence unleashed by the rapid support forces in other towns in North Kordofan. On Tuesday, the Jamaican government sent messages of gratitude to the Cuban medical brigades that helped Jamaica after Hurricane Melissa struck the island. The statement underlines that the Cuban medical brigade has been fundamental to Jamaica's recovery after the cyclone. 78 Cuban doctors have been working in hospital emergency services, ensuring continuous medical care to Jamaican citizens. 89 Cuban professionals were deployed in the most affected areas, and they provided medical aid even without electricity or drinkable water. The leader of the Cuban medical brigade to Jamaica, Dr. Katia Ochoa, stated that the doctors diligently followed protection and safety measures, and they personally supervised the situation in affected areas to emphasize preventive measures against potential epidemics in the population. Palestinian officials report that in October there were over 2,300 illegal Israeli Zionist settler and Zionist military occupation force attacks on Palestinians in the West Bank. The escalating Israeli Zionist violence came with the olive harvest season in the West Bank. The Palestinian Authority's Commission Against the Wall and Settlements reported that Israeli occupation forces and illegal Zionist settlers carried out a total of 2,350 attacks in the occupied West Bank during October. The Israelis are continuing a relentless campaign of violence against Palestinians, their land, and their property. 1,584 of these attacks were committed by the Zionist occupation military, while Zionist settlers were responsible for 766 attacks on Palestinians and their lands. The Israeli violence coincides with the annual olive harvest season, a time when Israeli attacks historically increase against Palestinians. The Palestinian Authority Commission documented incidents including direct physical assaults, the uprooting and burning of olive trees, obstruction of access to agricultural lands, and the seizure of Palestinian properties. In Gaza, Israeli Zionist military attacks occur daily, violating President Trump's so-called ceasefire. Israel has never honored any ceasefire agreement over the decades. Israel also continues to violate the so-called ceasefire in Lebanon. And in the final story, former Vice President Dick Cheney died at the age of 84 on Monday, peacefully attended to by his wife and daughters. Dick Cheney never faced any legal or political accountability for his war crimes over the past 20 years. The George Bush Jr., Richard Cheney administration created skyrocketing deficits, tax cuts for the wealthy, abuse of executive power, politicization of the Justice Department, the Hurricane Katrina debacle, the 2008 global financial crisis, and consummately lied the gullible U.S. public into the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Mr. Cheney is infamous for his work as the architect of the so-called War on Terror that murdered at least 4.5 million people over two decades and displaced 38 million people worldwide. That's been some of the news on the Progressive Forum.
Well, that's just about our time here. We're going to wrap things up. I want to thank Tom Hartman again for being on the show, and Lillian and Larry and everyone who contributed to today's show. And we're going to get out of here. My good friend Jacqueline Batiste is here, and she's coming up next, so stick around for that, and we'll see you next week.
KPFT Artist Profile.
Hi, I'm Carrie Melanson, K
KPFT has been completely, totally influential in my musical life, and I think the entire Houston music scene, it's a beacon for music arts, songwriting, Americana, roots music, things that you can't hear anywhere else. It's amazing. It's the local flavor that when you're driving across the country, you hope to find, you know, while you're on a road trip or something. You're not just hearing the same stuff on the streaming platforms, whatever, and you get to hear what's here. You get to hear what came here before, and it's really great. It's an education that everybody needs to hear these incredible songs. It's just an amazing opportunity for local and regional musicians.
Listen for his music and other independent artists here on KPFT Houston.
We've